I bind unto myself today. That hymn was written by the fabled Saint Patrick. It's called his Lorica, or his breastplate. We're going to talk about Saint Patrick here in the last hour of Issues, etc. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Will Wheaton is our guest for the next 25 minutes. Then we'll spend the last half hour with Wesley Smith. We'll get his reaction to Tuesday night's Nightline interview with Michael Schiavo. And his attorney, George Filos, will be talking about that in the next 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Pastor Will Wheaton is our guest. We're going to talk about the 5th century bishop and missionary St. Patrick on this St. Patrick's Day. Pastor Will Wheaton is pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, and a regular guest here on the program. Will, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. As always, a joy to be with you all.
Well, let's talk about the man himself. Even as I drove in today, it was somewhat comical. I pass right by Forest Park, full of people in green, usually a very strong Kelly green, full of people. It looked like having a very good time getting ready for the big St. Louis St. Patrick's Day parade. How much of that has to do with the real guy, St. Patrick?
Well, I think if there's a connection, it's this. It's very hard for a people who have been brought to Christ by a certain man to ever completely forget that man. And it's very easy for them to simply identify everything that marks them off as a people with the man who brought them to faith in Jesus Christ. And Saint Patrick's clearly is honored in that way by the Irish people. But the temptation then is to simply equate everything Irish across the years with Saint Patrick himself.
So, in a sense, St. Patrick's celebration, at least here in the United States, has become kind of a celebration of all things Irish rather than a genuine remembrance of this 5th century saint, bishop, and missionary.
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate statement.
Place him in history for us, if you would.
Well, he sort of comes toward the end of the great 4th century, where we saw, many times we've talked before about this flowering of patristic theology. And this this great synthesis of Christian teaching that took place in the fourth century, he's at the tail end of it. He's born sometime toward the end there, and we're not exactly sure where. A lot of people think that his parents were probably from Wales. Others argue no, it was further up the coast in Scotland. But we know his parents were from the mainland of Britain, and. His father was a deacon in the church. His grandfather was a priest. Of course, those were the days when you had married clergy. And Patrick was then, brought up in close proximity to the church, but he confessed that being a typical kind of a teenage guy, he didn't pay much attention to the faith that his parents and grandparents tried to hand off to him. And God used a 2x4, like he sometimes does, to get Patrick's attention. Patrick was kidnapped by a bunch of Irish pirates and hauled off to Ireland, where he worked taking care of pigs. And it was there, in his sufferings in exile, that he came to actually come to a living personal faith in Jesus Christ. And everything that he had heard before suddenly became real to him and important to him. Should we go on with his story?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. He had a dream, a vision that told him that if he went down to the coast, he'd be able to escape. So he makes his way down to the coast, and the sailors are like, well, you're going to go on board? You got any money? And he doesn't have any money. And it's really weird practice. The soldiers actually offer him their breast, one of their breasts, and he has to suck on their breast. And he says no, and turns away to leave. And they said, oh, come on, you can go on the ship. So they let the guy go on the ship. They bring him back to the mainland of England, where again the thought is probably Wales, where he catches up with his parents, and then moves on later down into Gaul, where he enters a monastery and becomes a priest, and has a great fervent desire to share the gospel of Christ, especially with these people that he lived among as a slave for a number of years. And his dream and hope of being able to do that finally came true in, I can't remember the exact date it was in. I think it was around 425, 426, somewhere in there. He was sent by the Pope, Celestine I, back to Ireland to witness and to evangelize. And although there had been some Christian presence in Ireland before Patrick, it was very sporadic, and it had not really taken hold or made big inroads into that island. But when Patrick came, the Lord really and truly blessed his mission, blessed his work. And as a result of his work, it is said that he founded more than 300 churches, and he baptized or was responsible for the baptism of over 100,000 people. So, I mean, it was a phenomenal bringing of people to faith that happened in his years there. And he died there, that he spent the rest of his life bringing Christ to the Irish people and organizing the church in that land. What he gave as the legacy to that church, kind of wonderful legacy, is this great missionary zeal. And so it was characteristic of the Irish, like of nobody else, to want to, the very learned people, very, very much preserving the culture and history they had received through Patrick, but they also were very eager to share the faith. And so monks from Ireland would travel sea voyages. They would risk anything to go to some place where somebody had not heard about Jesus Christ and be able to tell them about him and bring them to faith in this the strong name of the Trinity that you just heard in Patrick's prayer.
So while the comparison is not completely accurate, he was, in a sense, kind of the Billy Graham of his day. He was the one to whom at least the Irish people could point and say, this is a person who has spread far and wide among us and with some great success, as far as the human eye can detect it, the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Yeah, he would certainly be known. I mean, in our Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, in our new Lutheran service book, he is commemorated as St. Patrick missionary. It can never be forgotten that he worked so hard as an evangelist to bring people to saving faith and to get them baptized into Christ and move into the full life that God has for them in Jesus Christ.
Do you know what the native religion was of the Irish island when Patrick arrived there? Because I know that it was largely unchristianized.
Yeah, I'm really not that familiar with it. I remember reading about it a while back when there's a book by Tom Cahill called, I think, How the Irish Saved Civilization. And I think he just touches on that briefly about, pre-Christian Ireland. But I can't remember any particulars, but I want to think that it was sort of along the lines of the Druidic faith that was in England.
You have written recently about on the issue of mission, and since St. Patrick is remembered for, among many things, his missionary zeal, as you put it, you have written about, missiolatry? Or worshiping the mission? What do you mean by this term? In this age where the term mission gets rolled out and trounced out to excuse and to justify just about anything in the church?
Yeah, the thing Patrick had perfectly straight was that the mission of the church is to proclaim the gospel that people might be brought into a living relationship with the triune God, brought into the worship of the Blessed Trinity, as the great Athanasian Creed puts it. And this is the Catholic faith, that we worship one God in Trinity and Trinity in unity. The church goes out with the gospel to liberate people from idolatry and call them into the worship of the true God. And I see that this has subtly been replaced among us with an emphasis instead upon people going out to bring more people in. And it's like, what are they being brought into? What is the heart and core and center of the church's life but her worship of the Blessed Trinity? This is what people are being freed from idolatry for. This is eternal life. And I see a real danger when people start worshiping the mission, missiolatry, instead of worshiping the God who he sends, the God of the mission, the God who sends us out into the world to call all people from idolatry and into this worship of the triune God. Put it most simply, the purpose of the church is not to evangelize. The purpose of the church is to worship God. One of the jobs God gives us in this world is indeed to evangelize and summon all people into that worship, but the purpose of the church, its goal, its existence, is not something that ceases when time ceases. We will go on worshiping the Blessed Trinity with St. Patrick and all the saints forever. And this is what we are inviting all people into.
In other words, the mission of the church is not an end in itself?
No, right, precisely. The end of mission is worship. I always think about Jesus' discussion with the woman at the well in the garden of, Samaria, where he sat down, remember, and he had that whole conversation with her, and he says to her that God is to be worshipped in spirit and truth. He says the Father seeks such to worship him. The Father is after worshipers. That's what he's trying to save us from, because worshiping the true God, this is eternal life. And Patrick, he had a beautiful way of confessing this this true God. And I don't want to skip over this beautiful confession that he makes of the Trinity. Can I share this?
Yes.
It's sometimes called the Irish Creed. Patrick wrote his own little confession, his account of his life, which is how come we know so much detail about it. But near the beginning of that confession of St. Patrick, he says these words: "There is no other God, nor ever was, nor will be, than God the Father, unbegotten, without beginning, from whom is all beginning, the Lord of the universe, as we have been taught, and his Son, Jesus Christ, whom we declare to have always been with the Father, spiritually and ineffably begotten by the Father before the beginning of the world, before all beginning. And by him are made all things, visible and invisible. He was made man, and having defeated death, was received into heaven by the Father. And he has given him all power over all names in heaven, on earth, and under the earth. And every tongue shall confess to him that Jesus Christ is Lord and God, in whom we believe, and whose advent we expect soon to be judge of the living and the dead, who will render to every man according to his deeds. And he has poured forth upon us abundantly the Holy Spirit, the gift and pledge of immortality, who makes those who believe and obey sons of God and joint heirs with Christ. And him do we confess and adore, one God in the Trinity of the Holy Name. Isn't that beautiful?
It's dripping with scripture as well.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And it sounds like he knew his ancient ecumenical creeds, even as he's penning his own version of this creed.
Right, although, you know, how ancient is it? When he was living, you know, the Nicene Creed in its fuller form was only maybe, if you go back to 381, so what does that make it? It wasn't too ancient, you know?
We're talking about probably maybe 100 years old at the time in its fuller form. Pastor Will Whedon is our guest on this St. Patrick's Day. We are remembering 5th century bishop and missionary St. Patrick. Pastor Will Whedon is pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. In about 10 minutes, Wesley Smith will join us. Yesterday you heard us talk about and discuss with Father Johansson some of the Nightline audio from Michael Schiavo and from his attorney, George Filos, that was on Tuesday evening. Well, we got Father Johansson's response. I want to hear Wesley Smith's response coming up in about 10 minutes here on Issues, Etc., and that'll round off this last hour of the program. Well, let's talk about this hymn that is attributed to St. Patrick, the Lorica, the breastplate, and we heard it at the beginning of our conversation. What do you have to say about it?
Well, it really is one of the most stunning hymns that we sort of, in Lutheranism, we've recovered it of late. I think it first appeared in the Lutheran Book of Worship, and it might have been a worship supplement. I think it was in Worship Supplement in 1969. It sort of came to us from the Irish Church, and it is an absolutely gorgeous text. It's what appears hymnically is only part of the entire prayer of St. Patrick's breastplate. It's a little lengthy. Do you mind if I read it, though? The prayer?
Yes, please do.
Okay. I arise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through the belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation. I arise today through the strength of Christ's birth, with his baptism, through the strength of his crucifixion, with his burial, through the strength of his resurrection, with his ascension, through the strength of his descent for the judgment of doom. I arise today through the strength of the love of cherubim and obedience of angels and the service of archangels and hope of resurrection to meet with reward and prayers of patriarchs and predictions of prophets and preaching of apostles and faith of confessors and innocence of holy virgins and deeds of righteous men. I arise today through the strength of heaven, light of sun, radiance of moon, splendor of fire, speed of lightning, swiftness of wind, depth of sea, stability of earth, firmness of rock. I arise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look before me, God's ear to hear me, God's word to speak for me, God's hand to guard me, God's way to lie before me, God's shield to protect me, God's host to save me from snares of devils, from temptations of vices, from everyone who shall wish me ill, afar and anear, alone and in multitude. I summon today all these powers between me and those evils, against every cruel, merciless power that may oppose my body and soul, against incantations of false prophets, against black laws of pagandom, against false laws of heretics, against craft of idolatry, against spells of witches and smiths and wizards, against every knowledge that corrupts man's body and soul. Christ to shield me today. against poisoning, against burning, against drowning, against wounding, so that there may come to me abundance of reward. Christ with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ in me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ on my right, Christ on my left, Christ when I lie down, Christ when I sit down, Christ when I arise, Christ in the heart of every man who thinks of me, Christ in the mouth of everyone who speaks of me, Christ in every eye that sees me, Christ in every ear that hears me. I arise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation. Now, is that awesome or what?
And that's a fitting St. Patrick's Day remembrance. As we end here with about a minute and a half, no more, contrast, if you would, the way that the world remembers St. Patrick on a day like this with the way that the Church at least ought to remember St. Patrick, this bishop and missionary saint.
Well, the Church remembers St. Patrick for all the things that St. Patrick would have thought not worth much remembering. The Church, in contrast, remembers St. Patrick as a man who was mightily used of God to bring a whole nation to faith and to give to the entire Church some beautiful prayers and confessions which have remained in her spiritual treasury. She blesses God knowing that in heaven, together with Peter and John and all the other, you know, apostles, there's also the apostle to Ireland, St. Patrick.
Do you have to be Irish to be able to claim as an ancestor in the faith, St. Patrick?
Any person who is part of the Christian faith who can pray to this one triune God, any person who shares that faith with Patrick is his brother and sister.
Pastor Will Whedon, pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, joining us to talk on this St. Patrick's Day about the real St. Patrick. Will, thanks for being our guest again.
Thank you very much. You all have a great day.
The confession of the one true God. That is the essence of worship, at least from our perspective. To hear first of God's word and through his sacraments, and to be brought into communion with this one true God through Jesus Christ, our Savior, and his death and resurrection. And then to, with our mouths, confess in song and prayer and all other forms of worship that one true God. I like the way Pastor Whedon put it, that the mission of the Church, the goal of the Church is not to evangelize, but to worship that one true God and to draw sinners from every land, every time, every place into that worship through the preaching of Christ and him crucified. This is how that worship takes place, that worship that is genuinely in spirit and in truth. When we come back from this break, Wesley Smith will join us. We're going to listen to that audio from Tuesday's Nightline program, Michael Schiavo and his attorney, George Filos. And we'll get Wesley's response right after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called our Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues, Etc. And this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, here are the three levels of giving. The confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. And the reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. Now, each Reformation Club member receives premiums like monthly tapes, books, and transcripts. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club today by making a tax-deductible gift payable to Issues Etc. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Help us reach our goal of 125 Issues Etc. Reformation Club members by Easter. Issues Etc. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
Real church growth. How can we do it?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the book on death and suffering called Walking Through Shadows, Finding Hope in a World of Pain. Well, Ken, there are many ideas today on how to get churches to grow and reach our society. What are some of your ideas?
Well, you know, first of all, we need to understand why Christianity does not have the influence in our culture that it once had. See, over the years, Christians basically accepted evolution and thus rejected the book of Genesis as literal history. Now, because Genesis is foundational to all Christian doctrine, once you reject Genesis, then there's no basis for any Christian doctrines. Because of this, most Christians today don't know what they believe or why. They tend to doubt the Bible and thus can't speak with authority. You know, this has weakened the church greatly, causing many people to scoff at Christians who believe in God but can't defend their faith. And as a result, many churches have introduced entertainment programs to get people back to the church. But the real solution is to train God's people in the Word of God, teaching them doctrine and equipping them to defend their faith in the authority of the Bible. In particular, they need to be taught how to oppose the religion of evolution and millions of years and have answers from Genesis. And then as they go out and witness to the world, people will listen, be one to the Lord, and cause real church growth.
We can help you and your church have the ammunition to defend the Bible. Use our website, answersradio.com, for answers.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. In 374 B.C., the Greek philosopher Plato wrote, quote, "Shall we just carelessly allow our children to hear tales which may be devised by casual persons and to receive into their minds ideas which are the very opposite of those we wish them to have?" End quote. Plato knew that stories are value-laden and influential. Our children are especially impressed and influenced by the stories they see in the media. What kind of stories are your children watching? What values do they see exemplified in their sitcoms, docudramas, and talk shows? Stories are influential, and there are no better stories for your children to know than those from the Bible, which tell of Jesus and His love. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at cmli.org.
Here's what's coming up on our Bible study program. On Monday, we continue in the book of Joshua with chapter 22 and Pastor Thomas Eckstein. But next time on the Bible study, it'll be an Ask the Pastor Friday, and our good friend Pastor Joe Cox will be here to answer your questions and take your calls. Ask the Pastor on Friday here on the Bible study. Weekday mornings, 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
People's feedings, tooth feedings, are stopped across this country every day. If my wife wasn't the celeb, as everybody is calling her now, there would be no discussion in the legislation right now.
That's Michael Schiavo in an interview Tuesday night on Nightline. We played some of that audio yesterday for another guest and got his reaction. Wesley Smith joins us here in the last 25 minutes of the program, and I'd like his reaction as well to what was said by Michael Schiavo and his attorney, George Filos, during these last 25 minutes. Before we get to that conversation, yesterday I had to talk about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club completely out of breath because of a little snafu in our studio. I have my breath entirely intact now, and let me tell you in a more orderly fashion about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. First of all, we've got 117 members as of today. Our goal, 125 members in the next 10 days. That leads us right up to Easter. That's 8 members in the next 10 days to the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. There are 3 levels of giving: the confessor, the apologist, the reformer. If you'd like more information on those levels of giving and the benefits of becoming a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, our monthly donor program, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, all you have to do is go to our website, issuesetc.org, and you will find a picture near the bottom of the homepage of Martin Luther nailing the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg door. Click on that and you will find out more information about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, how to join. You can join there at the website, issuesetc.org. You can join by credit card. Just call our resource line number, 1-800-737-0172, or you can join by mail. Send your check to Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Again, 8 members in the next 10 days brings us to our goal of 125 Issues Etc. Reformation Club members by this Easter. We've got 117 right now. That's a very attainable goal for our listeners who want to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused outreach of Issues Etc. Wesley Smith is a regular guest. He is senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of several books, including his latest, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd. Is anything going on these days?
Lots of things are going on these days. Among them, last night, or Tuesday night it was, Michael Schiavo and his attorney on Nightline. Now, you didn't see Nightline, but we're going to be playing some of that audio, and you've got to react to a lot of this. It's just amazing stuff. I was thinking about you the whole time. But before we get started, you have written something in your blog.
Yes.
Why It's So Hard to Kill Terry Schiavo.
Yes.
Answer the question.
Well, I was thinking about this. You know, I mean, I've been writing about the Terry Schiavo case since, gosh, 2003. And I have watched and been quite gratified to see that literally the world start to come together to say that this helpless, defenseless woman shouldn't be killed. And I've been equally appalled at how much energy has been expended by so many people to make one poor, helpless woman dead. And so I wondered, why haven't they been able to succeed? And it strikes me that there are several reasons. First, I think the videos that the family posted on the Internet, and people can see them at terrisfight.org, T-E-R-R-I-S-fight.org, in which they show her reacting. For example, Terry, please open your eyes. She not only opens her eyes, she opens them so wide that she wrinkles her forehead. That is clearly not a, quote, reflex, as some of the people who want her dead say. And so the truth that she is cognitively awake is clear from the videos. Moreover, by showing these videos, seeing her smiling beautifully at her mother, for example, Terry became humanized. Because often, you know, we hear, oh, she's in a coma, or she's really doesn't have a life worth living. And it's abstract. And unfortunately, in a television age, unless we can see pictures, we often can't really think of it as true. You know what I'm saying? So the videos actually humanized her, made us realize that she's an us, a sister, a daughter, a friend, and not some kind of freak or some other. Second, killing really is best done in the darkness. The reason we don't know too much about what's really happening in the organ-assisted suicide, for example, is the state has put an iron shroud of secrecy over the whole practice. We never know what's going on there unless a little something here or there leaks out in the media, because you can't kill in the light. It's much more difficult, and it's been people of conscience with this thing so brightly lit now in the media with so many people working so hard to save her life. I mean, look at what's happening. You've got the United States Congress trying to pass a law that would allow federal courts to have jurisdiction. You've got the Florida legislature, again, attempting to pass laws that would protect Terry's life. And Jeb Bush must be given great credit for the efforts he has made now over several years to save her life. And I think that's because of the bright light of publicity that it wasn't media-driven, because the media tried to ignore this case, the mainstream media, and then the media still doesn't tell the whole story. This was driven by the people, and this was driven by alternative media. And so that's a very big part of the story. Third, I think people are no longer buying the notion that dehydrating someone to death is painless. I mean, the idea that you could take a woman who is conscious, take away all her food and water, and it would just be like palliative is ludicrous when you consider what some neurologists have told me, that people, if they're conscious, would feel it. And secondly, what Kate Adamson said in terms of a situation where she had a brainstem stroke and she was without food and water for 8 days at one point, not because they were trying to dehydrate her to death, but because she was recovering from some abdominal surgery. And she said that it was more painful to be without food and most fluids than it was for her to have the surgery where they didn't give her enough anesthesia, and this was abdominal surgery. And I've actually linked to that article I wrote in my blog, which is wesleyjsmith.com/blog. And finally, I think that this case marks a sea change. For so long, people have been meekly going along with what the, quote, experts in bioethics say and what the courts say. And, you know, there's a revolution going on. It's a peaceful revolution, and we're not going to listen to experts who do not share the moral values and sensibilities of the American people.
Wesley, we've got some audio from Tuesday's Nightline with Chris Bury. He interviewed Michael Schiavo and his attorney, George Filos. And in this first cut, I want your reaction to, and we'll try and keep our reactions as brief as possible, because
sure,
we got a lot of audio and a short time to get there. In this first, we hear from both Michael Schiavo briefly and then his attorney correcting something Michael has said. The question that has been asked here is, did Michael receive, by way of a malpractice suit settlement, any money?
Yes. Well, no.
And what happened to that?
You know, Michael didn't receive those funds. Those funds have been used for Terry's medical care and guardianship expenses and costs and fees over many, many years. Those funds are virtually gone, and Mr. Schiavo is not going to inherit or gain one penny by the result of Terry's death.
All right, Wesley, your reaction.
Michael did receive about $300,000 in that medical malpractice case as a consequence of loss of consortium and so forth. Terry received over $700,000, which Michael told the jury would be used for her medical treatment, testing, and therapy. The money was never used for those purposes. Michael insisted that no testing and therapy be done. And at the time he started this food and fluids deprivation proceeding in 1998, the guardian ad litem recommended against dehydrating Terry to death because Michael had such a gross conflict of interest in that he would inherit some $750,000. That meant what happened next was the guardian ad litem was dismissed from the case, and she's never had one since. And if the money is gone, it hasn't been for her medical care. It has been to pay George Filos about $500,000 to make Terry dead, and other attorneys even more than that.
So when George Filos says there that this money has gone to her care, it's actually, most of it's actually gone to his pocket.
That's correct.
All right, here is another from Tuesday night's Nightline. Michael Schiavo, listen carefully, folks, and I like your reaction as well, Wesley. Michael Schiavo talking about whether or not Terry will starve to death.
Terry will not be starved to death. Her nutrition and hydration will be taken away. This happens across this country every day. Death through removing somebody's nutrition is very painless. That has been brought to the courts many of times. Doctors have come in and testified. It is a very painless procedure. Terry can't, she has no cortex left. She doesn't feel pain. She doesn't feel hunger. So what's going to happen is slowly that her potassium and her electrolytes will slowly diminish, and she will drift off to a nice little sleep, and then eventually pass on to be with God.
Wesley.
Well, she won't starve to death. She'll dehydrate to death. And if she is conscious, which I think there's a very strong chance she is, and according to the sources I quote in that article that I wrote, which I link on my website, she would feel it. So, you know, we don't know for sure what she would feel because she can't communicate with us. But it seems to me that he's mixing apples and oranges. When people say that dehydration or not eating and drinking is painless, that has to do with when somebody is actively dying, say from cancer, and the body is shutting down, and the body, as a normal process, people stop eating and drinking because the body is not processing nutrition and water. And then if you give them water, for example, it'll all end up in their legs because they can't process it anymore. That's when it is medically inappropriate to give food and water because the body has shut down and cannot absorb it. In this situation, the only thing that makes Terry Schiavo different from you and me is, one, the level of her consciousness, and two, she can't swallow. If she is cognitively awake and aware, and if she can feel pain, and there have been, she's not brain dead, she is able to have reflex reactions, and by the way, she swallows her own saliva, then for him to just assume that she won't feel pain is a real dangerous and hubristic thing, and based on my sources, isn't true.
But it does sound like he is trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Of course he is.
He says the death by the dehydration and starvation is painless, but then he goes, but she can't feel pain.
And she'll just drift off to sleep to be with God. You know, baloney. If I quote in the piece that I linked, Ron Cranford, who is this neurologist who always goes into these cases, he's a fanatic to have people like Terry dehydrated to death. He's up in Minnesota. And I quote him from the Robert Wendland case, which was out here in California, which we've talked about many times on this program, where there was an order for dehydration, even though Robert Wendland could drive a wheelchair down a hospital corridor. And he was asked in the open court what it would be like, and he talked about these people turning blue and becoming ice cold and so forth, and he talked about putting Robert into a coma so he wouldn't feel the dehydration. So if why would you need pain control if dehydration isn't painful?
Chris Bury last on Tuesday evening on Nightline asked Michael Schiavo, why not just divorce Terry? Here's his answer.
Yes, I've moved on with my life, and I moved on with a portion of it, but I still have a big commitment to Terry. I made her a promise. And another reason why I won't give Terry back is that Mr. Schindler testified in court at the 2000 trial that he would, to keep Terry alive, he would cut her arms and legs off and put her on a ventilator just to keep her alive. So why would I give her to a man that would do that to you?
All right. Do you know what Michael Schiavo is referring to?
Yeah. Yes, I do. First off, notice the words, I will not give her back, because part of this whole thing is Michael thinks he owns Terry, and he's certainly treating her as if he owns her. He cuts off her visitation at will. He isolates her. He marginalizes her. He keeps her from having interactions. He keeps her from going outside, and he treats her as a thing, as an object. In fact, the way he wants her to die is treating her less than you treat a dog. If you took away the food and water from a dog, you'd go to jail. What happened in the situation with Mr. Schindler is, realize Mr. Schindler has not been very sophisticated in these kinds of issues. And during the original trial, when he was on the stand, he was asked if Terry got diabetes and if she needed amputations to save her life, would you do it? And he said that he would. And that he would put her on a respirator. But he did also say, and I've talked to him since, that, you know, he's not going to put her through that kind of chopping up process, nor would he. That was almost like a trick question asked in a trial by George Filos, who is a very expert in these cases, when Mr. Schindler was not expert, didn't understand really the import of what he was saying, and when the lawyer that Mr. Schindler had at that point had no idea what she was up against. I've talked to Mr. Schindler specifically about that situation, and he has explicitly stated that he would never force her to engage in undue suffering to maintain her life, but he doesn't think that taking away her food and water, which is not causing her any suffering, is something that should be done either.
On the subject of George Filos, Michael Schiavo's attorney, he was there as well.
By the way, were the Schindlers given equal opportunity to speak on this show?
There was no. In fact, they did play a soundbite from the father, but it was purely for kind of reaction purposes from Michael Schiavo.
That's disgusting. You know, this guy gets to go on with people who don't know this show, and he doesn't get asked the hard questions. And the minute he starts to step on himself, George Filos jumps in, who, of course, is going to write a book when all this is finished.
All right. Now, George Filos had some assertions to make about what the Schindlers want to do with Terry. He says they're trying to treat her as property, and he went on to say this.
Terry Schiavo is not a piece of property, not a suitcase that one person can give to another. She's an individual that has constitutional rights that have been adjudicated. It's a constitutional right to say, I don't want medical treatment, and the state can't force you to have it. She may be in a vegetative state, but her dignity requires that we honor her rights, and that's what this case is about now. Everyone's constitutional rights are at stake. You know, Jeb Bush in Florida is determined to become the George Wallace of his generation, standing on the courthouse steps saying we're not going to obey a court order that carries out a patient's constitutional right.
Okay, one attorney responding to another. Wesley, how do you respond?
The constitutional right that's being violated in this case is the right to life. What's happened in Florida has been a sham. It's been process over justice. You have a situation where you had the first trial, which was not well conducted by the Schindler's lawyer because she was not expert in these fields. Subsequent to that situation, you had a lot of evidence come out. For example, nurses in a nursing home in the mid-90s that took care of Terry, where Michael, they allege in a sworn affidavit under penalty of perjury, that he would come in and say, hasn't that bee died yet? Why isn't she dead? He would not even let them put things like a washcloth in her hands because he considered that therapy. This is a man who melted down his wife's wedding ring and engagement ring to make a ring for himself. He put her two cats to sleep. He was sleeping around on Terry within months of her becoming disabled. He was living with another woman just before the malpractice trial and had to stop living with her so he could get a lot of money. He's been living with another woman since 1996. He has two children by her. That is called abandonment of the marriage. And with all of the evidence that has come out that didn't come out in the original trial, for example, saying one thing in the medical malpractice trial, I will take care of Terry for the rest of her life, for the rest of my life, she will have a normal lifespan, and once the money's in the bank, suddenly saying she wouldn't want to live like this, none of that came out in the original trial. If this were a death penalty case, and I think the analogy is appropriate, you've got state action, that is, this is a state-ordered death. You've got new evidence that could very well impact on the decision. You've got a judge in the case who really did not follow the proper clear and convincing evidence standard. He decided beyond with clear and convincing evidence, which is close to beyond a reasonable doubt, because Michael Schiavo said his wife said back in the mid 80s that she wouldn't want to be maintained in such a circumstance. His brother and his sister-in-law. That's not clear and convincing evidence, particularly when you've got him saying something else under penalty of perjury to a different trial. If all of these things had come down in a death penalty case, say for Scott Peterson, the ACLU would never stop suing, saying there should be a new trial so we can get all of this evidence out and see whether or not justice requires that this action be taken. Instead, the ACLU is on the other side, and if anybody's constitutional rights are being deprived, it's certainly Terry's, but not because she's not being given the so-called right to die or the right to refuse medical treatment, but because her life is being deemed unworthy of being lived. And it's a travesty. Judge Greer, for example, for 3 years, did not require Michael to obey mandatory guardianship law in Florida, which required a guardianship plan prospective, that is, for the next 12 months, saying how you're going to take care of Terry and so forth. The only way the guardian even has power is when the judge signs that plan under Florida law. Yet for 3 years, Judge Greer meekly said, sure, you want more time? You have more time. So there was no guardianship plan in place. That's the heart and soul of the Florida protection statutes for disabled people like this, and nothing is done about it. So there's been a lot of violations, all right, but not the way George Filos talked about it.
Michael Schiavo had some final thoughts on Nightline, and I'd like a quick reaction from you, Wesley. Here's Michael again.
Just because this happened to Terry doesn't mean I don't still love her. She was a part of my life. She'll always be a part of my life. And to sit here and be called a murderer, an adulterer, like people that don't know me, and a governor stepping into my personal private life, who doesn't know me either, and using his personal gain to win votes, just like the legislators are doing right now, pandering to the religious rights, to the people up there, the anti-abortion people, standing outside of Tallahassee. What kind of government is this? This is a human being.
Wesley, 30 seconds to respond.
Oh, he is an adulterer and was for many years before this. That's uncontestable. Technically, he would not be a murderer since this would be a legal killing. And I think what the governor and the legislature is doing is in the best interests and traditions of the American people. And it's not just the religious right who are trying to stop this killing. It is also the disability rights movement, which are very liberal and secular, and who see their disabled sister being treated in a way that does not give her equal value of her life.
A real quick phone call here. Nope, our phone call is gone. One last question for you then, Wesley. What is the deadline for Terry, and what can we do?
You know, there have been deadlines before. This is a remarkable story. This woman is still alive. Supposedly the deadline is tomorrow at 1 o'clock when they're going to take away her feeding tube again. She's had her feeding tube taken away twice before. I think we should push on the legislature of Florida, which have both passed, the Senate and the Assembly or House have passed bills. They need to get those things, make it so that they're the same, so it can come out of the House and the Senate and be signed by Jeb Bush. We got to get the House of Representatives in the United States government to sign on to what the Senate just passed. And let's get a new trial in this case, and let's get all the evidence on the table, and then let's see what the right thing is to do for Terry. You know, the appearance of justice is crucial, and there is no appearance of justice in this case. A new trial with expert attorneys, with all the evidence coming out, is clearly what is required, not only for Terry, but for this entire society.
And then with only 30 seconds, people are going to talk about the feeding tube and the water as though they are medical treatment. And George Filos even called those things medical treatment. She's got a right to refuse medical treatment. Are food and water medical treatment?
Yes, when supplied through a tube. And most people are not aware of that. And then when they sign an advance directive saying they don't want medical treatment if they're in a certain circumstance, they're thinking of, as Terry might have been if she made any statements, they're thinking of respirators and kidney dialysis. Food and water, if supplied through a tube, are deemed medical treatment, just like aspirin, antibiotics, and a respirator. There's no such thing in the law as extraordinary care versus ordinary care.
It's a good thing to remember, folks. Wesley Smith, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and he is author of several books, including his latest, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. You can read Wesley's columns on the web at wesleyjsmith.com, wesleyjsmith.com. Tomorrow on the program, The Person and Work of Jesus Christ, with Dr. Norman Nagel of Concordia Seminary. Now, this is an important conversation. We talked with Dr. Nagel for this conversation, tomorrow's conversation, and both Jeff and I walked away from it saying that was vintage Nagel. But what made it vintage Nagel? What made it vintage Nagel was it was Christ-centered, it was cross-focused. You want to hear it? Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Norman Nagel. Also, we'll talk about the Passion of the Christ with Dr. Arthur Jest of Concordia Theological Seminary and the conclusion of our series on the Liturgy of Sickness, Death, and Dying with Pastor Will Whedon. Now, Sunday night on the program, the Lord's Supper is the subject. Pastor Matt Harrison of LCMS World Relief will be our guest. An in-depth discussion, a two-hour discussion of the Lord's Supper. It has a lot to do, by the way, with the subject we're going to talk about tomorrow with Dr. Nagel, the Person and Work of Jesus Christ, because His person is still with us, and His work continues in the Lord's Supper. That is Sunday night at 10 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis, the Lord's Supper, with Pastor Matt Harrison of LCMS World Relief. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.